Hello and welcome back to the Dive and Dig News Podcast, brought to you by the Honor Frost Foundation, a charity that supports maritime archaeology in the Eastern Mediterranean. My name's Lucy Blue, and this week we are going to be looking at the shores around the UK, in fact the southern coast of England, where Gary Momber, the director of the Maritime Archaeology Trust, has been working with a team uncovering submerged and intertidal archaeology. My colleague Lauren went to speak to Gary about these recent and exciting finds, some of which date back to over 5,000 years ago to the Neolithic period. Gary explains how these features got submerged in the first place and how they are going about rediscovering the archaeology just beneath the waves.
Okay, so I'm here with Gary Momber, who's the director of the Maritime Archaeology Trust here in Southampton. Hi Gary, thank you for joining us.
Hi Lauren.
I wanted to talk to you today about intertidal archaeology and about some recent fieldwork that you've been doing on the coast here off the New Forest. So I thought it would be really good to just start by understanding a bit, within the field of maritime archaeology, what we actually mean by intertidal archaeology, what that encompasses, and how you go about doing it. So could you give us a bit of an overview?
Yeah, well, intertidal archaeology is just the archaeology in that zone between high water and low water on the beach. So it's a zone that's wet most of the time, and then it dries out. And so effectively, you can get to these sites, sort of maritime, you can get to these sites when the tide's low. And historically, there's been a lot of intertidal archaeology looking at wrecks and hulks that have been pulled up on the beach and falling apart. But more recently, probably more in the last sort of 30 years, around the region, we've been looking at structures that were sort of built in the zone that's now intertidal when it was dry land. So effectively, we got ancient structures that were built thousands of years ago that are sitting there that have now become covered as the sea level came up and drowned them and protected them in silt.
And as an archaeologist, the logistics of working on these sites, obviously you don't have the issues of having to get into dive gear and get boats and everything like that, but it's still not quite as straightforward as, say, working on land, is it? There's lots of other challenges in terms of getting to the site, I suppose.
Yes, it is, and it depends on the site. And the thing about these intertidal sites, now, if I focus really on these sort of old landscapes, let's say, old landscape features, rather than shipwrecks for now, and the thing about those is they tend to be structures that are put places, maybe in harbours or along coastlines, where there was softer sediment, because they've been covered as the sea level's risen and sediment's dropped on them, it tends to be fairly soft and squidgy. And that's the case with harbours, somewhere like Langston Harbour, which I know you've worked in quite a lot. These harbours have got covered in the sediment and you don't really know how deep they are. So when you're going out onto the foreshore, quite often you're within areas where there's lots of silt and mud and holes you don't know. So you've got to be quite wary that you don't fall down into those holes.
Yeah, and absolutely.
And they tend to be linked to old paleo channels or channels that were there which have since been filled in, which are just covered in this much softer sediment. So there are hazards, and so you have to be cautious whenever you go out.
Brilliant.
Always go with at least two people.
Okay. And some good wellies.
And some good wellies, yeah.
And so the work that you've been doing this year, and particularly I think a bit last year, is off the coast of the New Forest, is that right? How did you first hear about that?
Yes, we've been working off the New Forest. Well, it stretches back to a project on the edge of the Bicolshott on the Cadland Estate, where there were some posts there, which, again, you know quite well. There are these Roman posts, which you did an initial survey on. We went back and had a look at them, discovered and dated them, discovered they're several dates Roman, just sort of pre-conquest and post-conquest, and then looked at other posts and they went right back to the Bronze Age. So we found these structures that were going back over 3,000 years. Now, this came to the knowledge of some of the other local residents of the region, and in particular Mary Montagu Scott, who approached me and said, actually, we got some structures like that and we've got some old forests just on the beach on the Beaulieu Estate. And so I went down and had a look, and then started discovering, the more you look, the more you tend to find in this particular site, started to discover these posts, and we looked at the posts and dated them, and they came up at 5,200 years old. Now, the reason we knew they were relevant is because they were associated with this forest, and the forest was growing on the land when sea level was lower. That meant that sea level had to be about 5 metres lower, because if it was near the low water in an intertidal zone, it gets covered by about 5 metres of water. So this was a time before the high tide would cover it, of course, so the sea level would have been about 5 metres lower, which takes you back into the Neolithic. So we had an inkling that was the sort of time frame. But then when we started to find the structures, it was quite sort of exciting that there was a these features now become eroding out of the silt.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it, is they're eroding out of the silt, because as you're walking along that intertidal zone, you often, you know, see bits of wood sticking up, and you might not necessarily straight away think that that is actually several thousand years old. But these residents are obviously seeing things changing, you know, quite quickly after perhaps a dramatic storm event or something like that. So do you think there's been an increase more recently in sites like this suddenly becoming exposed in that zone?
Well, they are, and that's right. These features that we're finding, we found Neolithic, we found Bronze Age, we found Roman, all in the same area. They are associated with one of these paleo channels that I mentioned, which is why you still got the trees there. But that is an area that was once, until very recently, covered and sealed. All those forests and wooden artefacts were sealed beneath the silt, hence they're protected for 5,000 years. So they have recently been uncovered. Say recently, I mean, over the last 30 years, we've been looking at the charts and looking at chart regression, and you can see in this zone, in the Western Solent charts going back to sort of 1781, Murdoch Mackenzie, for instance, it shows mudflats stretching right out, you know, in some places, a couple of kilometres out into the Solent, and all that's regressed now. And those mudflats were accessible at three-quarter high tide. You could walk on them, they're quite solid. And now there's pretty much nothing there. So all that's gone over the last 200 years. So it's not just now, as it were. It's actually been an ongoing process.
Yeah, and so then the archaeology comes in and we can date this stuff. And this is where we start looking at this bigger picture of how archaeology can tell us about long-term climate change. And I know that's something that you've been doing for quite a long time, actually, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. There's a couple of things there, and this can relate to a couple of the sites that I've talked about. There was the Neolithic forest with the Neolithic posts, and that's recently been exposed. So we can use that and we can look at the landscape, and we can understand when it was once dry, when the sea level came in, when it covered it, and that point, and when the mudflats moved in. And then we can gauge when the mudflats are starting to go as well, because we can start looking at some of the other more recent structures. There are Roman structures there, which would have been a pontoon or something that just recently been uncovered. And an interesting telltale sign there is when we first found these Roman features, let's say, dated about 250 AD, they were quite fresh and sharp on the surface. But then within a couple of years, the whole surface had degraded and lost. And this was about 20 centimetres of sediment. So the seabed effectively, or the intertidal zone, had dropped about 20 centimetres within a couple of years in that particular area. And we also found a Bronze Age sort of fish basket type structure dated about 3,200 years old, right at the low water mark. And that's been exposed and really degraded, pretty much lost within a couple of years as well. But that tells you, one, about the current rate of erosion, but also the fact it was built there within mudflats at the time, because the nature of the structure wouldn't have survived the open water. So that indicates that the different nature of the landscape when it was built. So they can be quite strong indicators of the changing coastline, the speed of which it's actually eroding now, as I said, with these Roman structures, and also the change in the morphology of the coastline over the last sort of 50, 100 years or whatever.
Yeah, they can tell us so much. And then how do you go about interpreting these sites? Because I guess that, you know, saying about the posts being potentially some sort of pontoon, and the Bronze Age, I think you said perhaps being related to fishing activity maybe, but it's quite tricky when you've got a series of posts in this area and you're trying to recreate the environment. Like, where do you start with trying to interpret the remains?
Well, that it is quite a challenge, because when you've got just the posts, all the things that they were holding are gone. So you were just left with a few little dots and a map, and you've got to join the dots to see if it makes sense. So what you have to do is you have to look at the material, look at the nature of the posts, how they're put into the land, the size of them, how they're pushed into the landscape, to try and understand how big they might have been and what sort of weight they might have supported. You look at the spread in the distribution of these posts, and then you can try and compare them with other analogous sites around the UK or overseas. So and also their sort of, if they're structural foundations, look like they might be foundations for a pontoon is one thing, or whether there might be a fish trap. Fish traps get quite common in the region, got sort of monastic fish traps, but they tend to have other indicators with them as well. Not only sort of shells and cobbles and things, but you'd have a bit of wattle and other indicative examples of diagnostic information associated with them. So they can be a bit of a challenge. I think going back to the the Cadlin site is a good example, where we've got all these Bronze Age posts and they're from dots on a map, and there's so many of them, and just to try and work out how they interrelate is quite a challenge. It's just, oh my God, I haven't really got there yet.
Yeah.
But then when we look at the what appears to be some form of causeway, that we have an initial, so Bronze Age date for that, and then that was developed in the Roman pre-conquest time, but then the larger timbers, the larger that cut across this sort of arguably causeway, whatever it is, for about 20 odd metres, they're sort of about 120 AD. So it looks like it's a site that was reused all the time that was developed. Mm. But by looking at the sediments as well, we can see that it actually cuts across an old paleo channel. So we can do some coring across parallel with the site, and you find that there's a little dip within the underlying land surface, and the infill sediments drop down below, and so you can see that it's a paleo channel. And then you can start working out the function and identifying what it would have been, and then try and rebuild the landscape around it as well to see what purpose it might have had, and then try and extrapolate that into how many people might have been around the area and what they were doing.
Yeah.
And the more we're looking, the more we're finding it was quite a, you know, busy bit of coastline, which otherwise you just wouldn't know anything about.
Yeah, I mean, and that's quite a process. So how do you go about recording them? Where do you start? You know, you've got a series of hundreds of posts potentially. What's the first step, really, in actually physically recording those?
So the first thing you've got to do is just try and clear and understand what you're dealing with. And then once you've cleared the air and you know, I suppose, the magnitude of the site within limits, you can then go and start recording, labelling, numbering, and start getting unique numbers for every individual item. Also, how it relates to the landscape. If you can't start making sense of it at that particular level, at that initial level, so there aren't any diagnostic features and it doesn't form typologically to a certain style or size, then the next thing is to maybe do some assessments of the sample, some of the timbers themselves. The step would be, if you've got the budget for it, is to get a carbon 14 date or do some dendrochronological analysis to try and get a date. So once you've got the date, then you can start maybe associating it with a certain activity that might be around at the time. And entirely, of course, is important because, as I said, the sea level's changed. So if it's an older date, the sea level might not have been there and it might be a purely dry land activity. Whereas if it's 2,000 years ago, sea would have been there and it would have been associated with the maritime structure. So there's all these different layers. I mean,
you know, we touched on how, you know, it's a pretty muddy, tricky place to get to sometimes. Do you think that the sort of the increase in use of things like drone technology is helping you to access further, you know, towards that low water mark in places? You know, we've talked about Langston Harbour and other harbours where it really is deep, deep mud.
Mm.
Do you think that technology is helping us find more sites?
Yes. It's very, very useful because it doesn't just help you find the sites. Sometimes some of these features can be really quite low, just linked in with the mud in the heart to see unless you're almost on top of them, which a drone wouldn't see. Sometimes features might be protruding, which a drone obviously would see at low water. But it's also a case that's really useful with the drones is that they can create digital terrain models. You can conduct surveys and you can create digital terrain models, so you can start linking those structures with the land surface and with the morphology of the topography. And that can really help you understand how it's changing. And then repeated cycles, of course, you can start monitoring the changes in the coastline and understand what's happening. Going back to your first sort of questions about the threats to the coastline, you can see whether these things are transient, whether there happens to be a storm and then you're going to get the mud sort of coming back or the shingle coming back, or whether the storm's there and then it's just gone and it doesn't come back and it just erodes away a bit more and then the sea levels are steadily dropping and dropping. I mean, the causes are something else. I mean, we always turn to climate change, of course. I'd say it's more of an indication of maybe climate change and coastal change. But many of the causes tend to be human interaction with the coastline. And that's the point I made about the marshes from 200 years ago. You know, the climate's been, sea level's been rising, the marshes built up, and the sea level hasn't really changed much in the last 200 years. But yet all the coastline, all the mudflats have been stripped away. Quite radically. Meanwhile, less sediment going into the system because a lot of it's taken out into agriculture, etc. And people are shoring up defending the shoreline, which means it's taking away the adaptability of the coastline. The coastline is no longer adaptable and can't really respond to any changes in sediment load, or it just tends to stop and erode away. And that's the trouble with sea defences, is they're defending against something that maybe they shouldn't bother be defending. They didn't need to be there, but there. And by defence, they tend to push the sea back.
You know, as an archaeologist, it's great for us in that these sites are becoming exposed and we can see them and we can study them, we can understand them. But then the rate at which all these sites are being exposed, there's not enough archaeologists, intertidal archaeologists, to go and record these before they then could be lost again. And that's a massive challenge.
It is a challenge. It's, and I think the way that's got to be approached is maritime archaeologists or archaeologists along the intertidal zone, there aren't enough because it's not really, as a discipline, not really valued in a way it should be. Also, there isn't really any legislation to support natural degradation of these artefacts. However, there's a lot of concern about climate change. And when you start to identify that there's a place to help inform these changes along the coastline by looking at this heritage material, then I think resources could be applied to support those maritime archaeologists to do their work, to see how it can be applied to understanding the past, not just in its own right, although that's important in its own right, but I think there's other issues that can be brought to bear to really increase the significance of this in a way that social concerns can be addressed and finances can be brought to bear to support some of this research. So I think the more we make it known that this material is there, not just significant in its own right, but can tell us about the past, the better it's going to be, then the more support will come research it.
Yeah, oh, I hope so. And so what's your next plans for sort of the Cadland and Thorns Beach sites? Are you planning to do any more field work this year, do you think?
Yes, hopefully there should be some monitoring ongoing and monitoring the sites, monitoring changes. We can only do it on decent low water tides. And then we're finding more and more stuff all the time. So we'll carry on with those inspections, interpretation, and rescue what we can. I mean, they say this Bronze Age site's 3,200 years old. It's just going. We've defended it for the time being, but it's just going. We've slowed down the rate of decay, but we need to get out there and recover that. Problem as well is when you've got it, what you do with it? Mm. You need to put it somewhere. So there's a need to get a nice big, some form of exhibition centre somewhere or museum that can house it and tell the story of the evolution of the Solent. I mean, we're talking locally now, but the evolution of the Solent, and try and preserve some of that wonderful material before it's gone.
Well, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. Good luck with the fieldwork, and I hope to join you maybe on the Bronze Age site if you're going out there.
Well, you're always welcome.
Thank you very much.
Wow, it's amazing, isn't it? What can be found beneath layers of sediment literally just off the foreshore? I'm really looking forward to hearing more about Gary's discoveries, and thanks to Lauren very much for a really, really fascinating interview. I hope that you've enjoyed this week's news podcast brought to you by the Honor Frost Foundation. Dive and Dig's the name, and I hope you'll tune in again soon. Cheers.